Coming up next, Michael Downey is on the podcast, former Tennis Canada CEO. Michael said, good people lose jobs. That was one of his piece of advice he gives to people when they lose their job. If he didn't lose his job at Molson, there would have never been a 20-year run at Tennis Canada that also included a 3-year stint at the Lawn Tennis Association in Britain. Can you imagine how much he's changed tennis in Canada? And that might have not even happened. So whenever you have a setback, think of that. I really hope you enjoy this episode. This episode is sponsored by Alex Hill. Alex is a sales representative at RE/MAX Escarpment Real Estate. He's also one of RE/MAX Canada's top 30 under 30. He was on the podcast a few episodes ago with his brother, Matty Hill. If you're looking for real estate needs in Hamilton, Stony Creek, Burlington, or any of the surrounding areas, you can hit up Alex at alex@teamgrande.com.
Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line.
Today on It's Not a Straight Line, I'm honored to have Michael Downey. Michael had this incredible career with Labatt, Consumer Packaged Goods, MLSE, Skydome, Molson. And then, Michael, you found your way into tennis as the president and CEO of Tennis Canada from 2004 to 2013, and then again from 2017 to 2024. And in between, you had the opportunity to become CEO of the LTA, the Lawn Tennis Association in the UK. I think you also had a seat at Wimbledon, like a non-voting chair position or non-voting board position. So I'd love to hear about that. But Michael, welcome to the show.
It's an honor to be part of this. Thank you, Jordan.
So Michael, I wanted to start off with, let's start off with the Raptors before we go back through the early parts of your career. How the heck did you get recruited to work with the Raptors in their very first year of existence? And now it's 30 years.
Yeah, no, it feels like yesterday, actually, because the 4 or 5 years I worked for the Raptors were one of the major highlights of my career. So, Jordan, I was 34 at the time, and I was running new business development for Labatt Breweries. And I got a call from John Bidoff, who was the co-owner of the Toronto Raptors. And he was looking for his first kind of, in today's definition, CMO, CRO. And he had a reference from my competitor, David Perkins, who was the president of Ontario Molson Breweries, had actually recommended me because we knew each other from a prior life. And I interviewed with John, and I remember I was a bit irreverent back then, and I had really long hair. I wore one of those long Australian wetback coats, and I sat down and interviewed with John, and his opening remark was, "You must be good to get away with that look at Labatt Breweries." And I knew I was going to like this guy. And we interviewed, and we cemented a deal over a couple of weeks. And I will say that I cut my hair and became more professionally looking, not because John asked, but because I just knew I was in the service business now. And not everyone is necessarily going to respond well to kind of that maverick look. So, but it was a great run, and I'm always indebted to John for giving me the opportunity.
And I know, Michael, watching your career and being in the sports sponsorship and now not-for-profit world, a lot of people were looking at what you were doing at Tennis Canada, and it was one of those NSOs that you're just like, wow, the talent development, the things you were doing in the communities and all of that. But you didn't, set out on a path to get into sport management necessarily.
What built the foundation for your career after school at Ivy? I know you went to Western.
My father, who spent his life in marketing and advertising, and he also worked in the beer business, he had always said to me, look, you know, if you want to get into advertising, go through the packaged goods marketing route first, because you'll get better training there. And that's why I was lucky enough to be hired by a company called Warner Lambert. Warner Lambert doesn't exist anymore. It's Pfizer and Cadbury now. But I got great training there for 5-6 years. And then I took an international posting with Warner Lambert. And I was actually the youngest expat in the history of the company. Where at 28 years of age, I was the sales and marketing director of the affiliate in Indonesia, in Jakarta, Indonesia, of all places. I remember when I was actually offered the job, I didn't even know where Indonesia was. And I had to do some research on it. But I got some good grounding there. And I also worked, when I came back from Indonesia, among many jobs, I worked at Labatt Breweries. And that was a great experience too, because it was packaged goods marketing, but really heavy in the sponsorships and promotion. In those days, you know, the beer companies were the leader in this area. And so I got a lot of experience, because I was actually running from a marketing end the country's biggest brand at the time. If you can believe it, it was Labatt Blue. I think it's a discount beer now, but it had about a 50 share of the market, and it sponsored everything from the Blue Jays to World Cup skiing to, you know, we did concerts with Tom Cochran. And so I got a lot of experience in the promotional side. And I think that helped, because I remember when Bidoff hired me, I had no sport pedigree. And he said, I don't care. He said, you've got packaged goods marketing training, so you can think strategically. You've got promotion experience because you worked at the breweries. You're a risk taker because you went to Indonesia. And you've obviously faced some personal trials and tribulations because you're divorced. And he actually told me all of that. So, but I always loved sports, Jordan. My father used to say to me when I was a kid, I didn't read the sports page. I actually studied it. But I never thought I would actually get into sport. Like, it just was one of those things that it was never part of a plan. But I don't regret at all the opportunity at 34 and joining the Toronto Raptors in its inaugural year.
I don't know if you want to touch on the inaugural year, or you took Skydome, I believe you were part of it, out of a bankruptcy. What were some of the trials and tribulations with maybe being involved with the Raptors in the first year that helped you grow, that maybe other people could learn from?
Well, it was, you know, I was a corporate guy up until that time. I had always worked with corporations, Labatt, Warner Lambert, an ad agency, Bozell, Palmer Bonner. It was the first time I actually worked for entrepreneurs. So, you know, my bosses were John Bidoff and the Bidoff family and Alan Slate and the Slate family. And I learned a lot from entrepreneurs. Like, it's their money. And, you know, you run a business a little differently when it's their money. You hate to say that, but I think it's actually true. And, you know, you're probably more accountable because you're talking about their wealth. And the other side of it was, man, do they take risks? And I think there's something about entrepreneurs that, you know, they just don't go a straight line. And a lot of it is, you know, thinking from the hip and seat of the pants and, you know, just gut feel. Like, I still remember being in a board meeting at the Toronto Raptors, and the short of it was Alan Slate had won the shotgun with John Bidoff, and he owned like 90-95% of the Raptors. And he was building Air Canada Center, and the Leafs were at least saying they were going to build a building on top of Union Station. And so there was a war going on here. And I remember in the board call, the bankers telling Alan, you know, Alan, you can't keep building this building. Like, you're risking your wealth. And Alan turned and said, it's my only option. The only way I will get the Toronto Maple Leafs to the table is to keep building the Air Canada Center, because they need to stop the construction to make it more friendly for hockey. He was right. He was right. But, you know, that was a very smart individual that knew that that was how he was going to get the merger in place, was that the Leafs were never going to build in Union Station and they needed to stop Air Canada Center to actually, you know, change a few things to their liking. So, you know, how that influenced me in the future, I don't know. Did I become a little more risk-taking, a little more entrepreneurial? Probably. But it was a great experience and I learned an awful lot from it.
That's incredible. And I know you worked with so many amazing people doing incredible things in the sports industry today, whether, you know, I've heard on Gavin Ross podcast, Chris Overholt and Jeff DeLine and, you know, so many incredible people, Hopkinson. What was it like when you, so you were at Molson, and I think you were involved in their Molson Sport and Entertainment. You were a regional vice president or president there. And then this opportunity came along, or maybe how did the opportunity come along for Tennis Canada?
I lost my job in Molson. So I went into Molson as, you know, in today's terms, chief marketing officer, and I centralized marketing, closed some regional offices and centralized marketing in Toronto. And then I also was president of what was called Molstar at the time, and we rebranded it Molson Sports and Entertainment. Then I got promoted to be the regional president for Ontario Western Canada. Quite frankly, I took on too much and lost my job. You know, good people lose a job all the time. And so I was out in the marketplace for 9 months, you know, working without placement counselor. What am I going to do next? The first time ever in my life had been unemployed. I still remember the day I lost my job at Molson's. I got up at 6 a.m. and cut the lawn. Like, you know, what was I going to do? So anyway, I worked with an outplacement counselor, Lou Clements, who was very good. And quite frankly, I still talk to Lou, you know, some 25 years later for advice. And he helped scope out kind of what was important to me. And what was important to me at the time was I wanted to be a CEO. I wanted to be in a marketing-led company. I wanted change. Like, I love change. I love managing change. I'm not a good kind of status quo manager at all. People like to say I like new shiny things. So, and I wanted to be in sport. Like, one of my downfalls at Molson was I was running the biggest region, and I was also the president of Molson Sports and Entertainment. And quite frankly, I was more interested in Molson Sports and Entertainment. And all the great things they were doing there. So, yeah, I think that was telling to me. So Tennis Canada was looking for a new CEO. A recruiter called me. You know, tennis, you know, highbrow, white sport, country clubs. I'm not sure I really want to do that. But I did interview, and I was quite taken by the opportunity. They were in the midst of building a new center in Toronto. And I also saw it as a time where the company was known best for these two tournaments they ran in Toronto and Montreal, but they had no success, like really next to no success in high performance. So I saw it as an opportunity to test my mettle in something different. And again, I joined in May of 2004, I guess, and had a great run.
And were you a fan of tennis? Did you play tennis?
I like to say, well, I can play tennis poorly. And I would tell people I don't play tennis because with my title, if people thought I played, I'd be invited to by pro-ams and events like that. And I just embarrassed myself. So I basically just told people I don't play to avoid being invited. I was always a fan, like, you know, I've said in a bunch of interviews, when I accepted Tennis Canada, my grandfather, bless his heart, would be smiling because he loved tennis. And I remember as a kid going up to his cottage and I would go out and try to play tennis after watching like the US Open final or Wimbledon final. And my grandfather would always come up, and he actually was disabled and actually couldn't play tennis, but he loved it. So, but no, I had no pedigree. And I still remember
you know, when I interviewed for the position, I had to position myself differently, I think correctly, actually, where I said to the interviewers, look, no disrespect, but your CEO doesn't have to be a tennis player. Like, your CEO is a leader and has to develop strategy and has to motivate staff and inspire staff. And quite frankly, your CEO can hire good tennis people, you know, like, and they bought into that. And I actually think that's what Tennis Canada needed at the time. They needed an outsider to come in and take a different view of the sport, because it had been run by insiders for decades.
Yeah, I'd always find that interesting, right? When things are run by insiders or the same people for so long, they're not getting those different thought points. It's like groupthink, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of common sense. Like, I used to say to myself, because I had a long run at Tennis Canada, I did 9 years, as you said, and then I did another 7 or 6. So I did 15 in 2 tranches. And I used to say to myself, and I say it to, every once in a while, I have to pinch myself, not because I'm happy, or I was happy, because you just need to kind of like slap yourself in the face to say, am I actually just accepting things now? And am I orchestrating the level of change that's actually required? And the longer you're at something, the more difficult that is, because you really have to look inside and say, wait a minute, am I just accepting this because it's the way we've always done it? And it might be successful. So I use that comment, you know, I pinch myself just to kind of wake myself up to say, hey, wait a minute, am I becoming complacent? And I'm not saying every manager or employee that has a long run becomes complacent, but I do think common sense says you kind of start accepting the norm because you are the norm.
Yeah, and I if I've heard correctly, you did some interesting things either when you were pitching yourself the first time or the second time. You had a presentation about Tennis Canada and you reframed it to Tennis in Canada.
Oh, yes.
Tennis Canada.
Yeah, no, it wasn't really, I used it in Britain. Like, I used what I did in Canada to help me get the job in Britain. I remember interviewing for the job in Britain and they kept talking about the LTA. And I said, you know, you stop talking about the LTA. The LTA has to be about tennis in Britain, and the key word is in. That is, that you are facilitating growth. It's not about our organization. We're a facilitator, so we need to be thinking about tennis in Britain. And I actually used that strategy in Canada. I still remember it was one of my first major presentations, that it was at a coaching conference, and there was, like, you know, a few hundred coaches at the Toronto Center. And hell, like, am I a fish out of water? Like, I don't even play tennis, let alone, you know, I'm talking to coaches. Like, they must have thought I was daft. But I got up and I actually had our marketing department give me a different logo. And I put the Tennis Canada logo up. And then I said to all the coaches, but this is actually the logo that Tennis Canada should be working in. And it was Tennis in Canada. And it resonated really well. Because I think in the coaching fraternity, and I think I'm generalizing here, there was a belief that Tennis Canada would always try to take credit for things that maybe external coaches did. And I think I was one of the first to talk about tennis in Canada, and we are facilitating, and it's as much about what you do and how do we facilitate your growth, whether it's a player or a coach or a community leader in that end. And I used to always, you know, every once in a while, I'd actually critique our own coaches, because a player would do really well, like Milos Raonic or Eugenie Bouchard. And they'd, of course, be going like this and patting themselves in the back and talking about how great the program is. And I'd have to remind them that, you know what, like, we're not on court with Milos Raonic. And he had other coaches before he joined the national program at 17 years of age. So, like, be a little more humble that other people actually contributed to his success. And at the end of the day, his success is first and foremost because of himself. And be more humble. And I used to also say, you know, you can be humble and we're still going to get our accolades, because the general public is probably going to give Tennis Canada more credit than they deserve because we're the governing body. So at the end of the day, and that happens, eh? Like, you'll see articles written, you go, whoa, Tennis Canada is really great at this.
And we probably got more credit than we deserved. Now, we did great things and we did change things. So I'm not underestimating the power of kind of a different high performance program. But I think a lot of it is be humble and realize that there's a lot of people in the pathway of excellence, parents, high school teachers, fitness coaches, external coaches, before you layer on Tennis Canada. And the provincial associations have a lot to do with it too, like in you know, because they do competitive structure and that's where these kids compete until they get older.
Did you also, was that also part of your leadership to be humble, to teach people that, to, you seem like a pretty calm, collected person. Like, can you talk about your leadership a little bit over those, that 20 year span?
Yeah, I'm not sure I was all that calm.
And you also, I also hear you like to get into the weeds. That was another reason, not, but you like to get into the trenches, which is another reason you saw Tennis Canada as a good path for you.
Oh, absolutely. Like there's no doubt, you know, and this is part of your growing up experience of kind of what are you good at and what are you not as good at. And quite frankly, you know, when I was in charge of Molson, Ontario, Western Canada, and it had like three breweries and it, you know, I don't know, a couple thousand employees or whatever, that wasn't my strength. I am a hands-on leader. I like to get into the trenches. And I'm not saying that, you know, leaders of big organizations, you know, don't go deep too, but it tends to be what I like to do. So actually a Tennis Canada was better suited for me. Like we had, when I joined, we had 65 employees. You know, when I finished, we had double that, but that's a pretty small organization. So I do think it was better suited for me because I am a fairly casual, you know, roll up your sleeves type of leader. I also think, you know, it was interesting when I retired from Tennis Canada, the tennis development group that's led by Eva Haveris, who I had hired, did a little celebration for me. And they actually talked about Michael Downey 2.0 and the difference between Michael Downey 2.0 versus 1.0, which was pre the LTA. And I know this is true. Michael Downey 1.0 was probably more serious. I was known for like walking down the hallway. I got to go see somebody. And like, I would ignore anyone I see all the way. And I would only go to people's offices when I had something I had to talk to them about. And so it was all task orientation. And I think in 2.0, for whatever reason, maybe, I don't know if the LTA changed me or I was just older. I spent more time with people the second time around. I got to know them. And I think it was highlighted actually by a manager in our Montreal office who I had known in my first run. And I was sitting in his office at the start of my second run. And he said, Michael, I hope you don't take offense to this, but like the last time around, you wouldn't even have known who I was other than my name. And now you're sitting in my office asking about my family. Like this is so different and so refreshing. And I never forgot him calling me out in that way. So I do think over time, I kind of mellowed and realized, you know, a lot of it, leadership is working through people and showing the empathy in their life. And I think it may have come to me a little later.
That's such a good realization and good for that guy to call you out on that and just have some fun with it. And, you know, it's fun to see the transition of how your leadership journey would have changed over time. You know, Michael, this is called, it's not a straight line. We never know what's going to hit us in life. I know in 2009, you heard those three words, you know, you have cancer, right? And I'm not sure how publicly you've been with that story, but what was that like? What were the first thoughts that came to mind and how did you journey on?
Yeah, I heard those words twice on the same day. So I remember it was a July day and it was actually in 2008. It was a July day in 2008. It was actually during our major tennis tournament in Toronto and Montreal. And I had gone to, a urologist in the morning with my wife at the time. And he said, look, you know, sorry to tell you this, but you've got prostate cancer. You've got a Gleason score of 6. You know, no rush. You know, here's a few pamphlets. Come back in a month and let's talk about actually, you know, what we're going to do. And, but later that day, I was going to see another doctor as pre-work for a colonoscopy test. And I had had periodic blood in my bowel. And you need to be honest, he did a physical check and he said, I think you need to sit down. And I go, what do you mean to sit down? This was later on the same day. And my wife was not with me at the time. She had something else to do. And he goes, well, I hate to tell you this, but I think you have colon cancer. And I go, well, how do you know that? He goes, I could feel it. And I go, well, I just was diagnosed with prostate cancer this morning. And he goes, oh, what? And I said, is it the chance, like naively, is it the same thing or whatever? And he goes, no, it's not the same thing. But like, do you have the doctor's name that you were brought? So he called the other guy and they compared notes. And I had in the best of two cancers. Later that week, I was diagnosed with grade 3 rectal tumor. So he's a little off. It wasn't colon cancer. It was rectal tumor. And I actually remember reaching out to a donor of Tennis Canada. I don't normally would do this, but now is my life. And I reached out to a fellow named Jim Fleck, whose name is on the prostate ward at Princess Margaret Hospital. And I said, Jim, like, I've got some bad news. I've got prostate cancer. You know, can you help me? And he goes, oh, I'll get you in to see the head doctor, John Trachtenberg, I think his name was, at Princess Margaret Hospital. I went in to see John, and John basically said, Mope, you got prostate cancer. You're 49 years of age. We're taking it out. And he gave, you know, he said, we're going to get radiation and chemo. A week or so later, I came back to see John, and John said to me, we'll get a change of path. And I go, what do you mean a change of path? He goes, well, all the, you know, we've had a forum on your file, a bunch of different experts have obviously commented, and we're not going to take out your prostate. And I go, well, you told me like a week ago, you're taking it out. He goes, your rectal tumor will decide your longevity. That's where we're going to focus. So I went into radiation and chemo pre-Christmas and had the tumor removed in December. Everything was successful. They were worried about some lymph nodes, but they weren't cancerous. And so that was, and I got out of the hospital. I got out of Princess Margaret about 2 days before Christmas, actually, and couldn't wait it out, actually, because I'd been in the hospital for about 3 or 4 weeks and lost, I think, 30 pounds in that end. So it was quite an ordeal. I will tell you that the Princess Margaret was superb. And, you know, they saved my life. And I'll tell a side story. I remember it was a female surgeon who was going to operate on me, Cassandra Eason. And she was quite young looking. And my wife and I were sitting in front of her and she was talking about doing the surgery. And I could see the uneasiness on my wife's face. And my wife finally spoke up and said, like, you're really young. And the doctor said to her, well, I'm not as young as I look, but thank you very much. And I said, look, I've always been successful. I have 100% track record. And two, I've got an advantage over most men. And we looked at her and said, what's that? I have small hands. And where I'm going, small hands is an asset. And, but I will say, I'm rambling on you. She was successful getting the cancer out. And I still remember her telling me that, and I can't remember, I'll get it mixed up. She said, when you wake up, if you have, you know, an incision on this side, you're going to have a temporary bag. And if you have an incision on the other side, you're going to have a permanent bag. And I got all confused waking up, which was the left and which was the right. And when she came in, I was actually more interested to know whether, am I going to have a permanent bag or a temporary bag then were those nodes cancerous, which would have been like very serious. So she told her the nodes weren't serious, weren't cancerous, and you're going to have a temporary bag.
And how did that experience change your life and career once you made it through to the other side of cancer? Like it changes everybody in different ways. And what was your attitude as you went through it?
Well, I think, you know, and again, I'm probably reinventing some history here, but I think it tests your resiliency. It sure tests the resiliency of your family. And I do feel for my wife at the time because, you know, she's got to pick up more responsibilities. We had two young teenagers at the time. And like, you know, I had to look after myself and that end. So there was an awful lot of pressure on my spouse and my kids in this end. You know, the story is deeper. It was a ride. You know, it was successful, but I had all kinds of complications. So I had a seizure about a week after I got out of the hospital where I actually couldn't speak.
Wow.
And I had to be taken to emergency. And I still remember being in the emergency waiting room at Princess Margaret, and I couldn't speak. And they never found out what was wrong, but I lost my license for 6 months. And then, you know, I did have, which is quite appropriate, I had a temporary bag for six months, but I also had a catheter for 9 months, for God's sakes. And I remember the surgeon at the time being mad at me because I kind of had a black mark in her perfect record that she'd been successful with all these surgeries, but she'd never had one where, you know, somebody had a catheter for 9 months. And so, you know, my wife used to say to me, like, I think she was scared when I went to bed because I had all these appendages hanging off me, you know? So it was quite testing. And I still remember going to Indian Wells tennis tournament in California in, I guess it was March. So I'd had the surgery in December, and now I was on, you know, preventative chemo, and I should never have taken the trip. Like when I landed in Indian Wells, I was immediately sick, and I was there for a week, and I think I lost 10 pounds in that week, actually. So it was trying, but I'll end it on this note and then I'll answer your question. I ended up, you know, having to learn to put in a catheter. Because the doctor just said, Michael, you can't keep doing this. Like, you keep coming down to emergency every few weeks and thinking you're infected. And so then we change it. You've got to learn to do it. And so I had to learn to do it. It's amazing what you can do in that regard, in that space. But the funny side of it was I learned to do it. And I think the second day after, if you don't mind me saying, I couldn't get the catheter. I just couldn't get it in, and I was bloated, and I'm saying to my wife, Jesus, I'm going to have to go down to the hospital again, and I got to put a catheter in, and I was all freaking out, and she said, go upstairs and, you know, take a shower or something. Take a shower and just calm down. I went upstairs, took a shower, got out, and I, for whatever reason, because I had not done this in months, I said, I'm going to see if I can go to the bathroom. I actually peed all over the wall.
Wow.
And I still remember going back to the doctor saying, like, what the hell happened here? And I think the doctor at the time said, I think it was mind over matter. I think you were so damn scared of putting a catheter. You found a way to actually urinate on this end. So I will say that every time I urinate, I still smile.
Because that's amazing.
That was still a very traumatic side. So at the end of the day, to finally get to your question, I think it tested your resolve. I realized I was pretty strong to go through this. I do think it sensitized me to kind of my workaholic approach to life. I think for a while I kind of read the tea leaves and probably broadened my life, but I think I fell back into what I was most of my life. But I will tell you, I'm full of stories here. I eventually got divorced, and I was on a plane flying to Vancouver, and I was reading a book. I think it was What Color Is Your Ferrari? And it was like a life-changing book. And the lady sitting beside me said, like, that's a weird book to be reading. And I explained I had cancer and I just recently separated and all of this. And I think it actually brought in a new woman into my life, that she thought I was a pretty sensitive, you know, caregiving individual that was pretty balanced. The guy's reading this book. And I think over time she's realized she's still married a workaholic, but we are together after 12 years.
Oh my God.
We actually met on a plane when I was reading that book.
Wow. And then, you know, you were with Tennis Canada, and then you went over to the LTA, the Lawn Tennis Association. Did you have a seat? Was it the All England Club or the seat on Wimbledon?
No, I was on the, actually, I went to every management committee meeting for Wimbledon, but technically I wasn't on management committee. I was a guest. But I still remember making a speech to them and saying, you know, it's an honor to be the only expat that's ever been on management committee. And I realized right then a bunch of them were looking at me going, no, you're a guest. You don't have to write. And everything's formal over there, right? So you got to get these things right. But no, I actually got to sit in every management committee meeting. It was amazing to watch how that tournament is run. You know, their strategy documents continually use the word perfection. I've never actually seen that. They want to be perfect. Like, it's not about being excellent or brilliant. It's actually perfect. And if you've ever been to Wimbledon, they try to be perfect. They just do, actually. Like, you know, the story I'll tell is that, and if anyone's been to Wimbledon, you know that everything's pristine. Like, you don't see beer kegs being moved around. You don't see cables for TV. Everything is pristine. And it's because all those grass courts actually have tunnels underneath them, and everything's done through tunnels. And I remember sitting in a management committee meeting once and saying, like, you should tell a story about that. Like, that's a great article. And some guy looked at me and goes, why would we want to tell people how we become pristine? Like, we want them to think we just clean really well on this end. He said, Michael, it's like going to a restaurant, a high-end restaurant. You never get into the kitchen because they don't want you to see the chaos of the kitchen. Well, the tunnels are their chaos, actually.
That's incredible. And I'm a huge tennis fan, and I've never been to Wimbledon, the tournament, but I visited Wimbledon and got to go on a tour, and it was pretty, pretty amazing. What, so like, it's not a straight line, Michael. You said it. You've been divorced three times, or is it two times?
Two times.
You've had this incredible career that didn't even start in sport. You're with Tennis Canada for a long period of time. What was that push to be like, I'm going to move to London. I'm going to take on this LTA role.
It was kind of interesting. I think actually my wife Jinder is a big part of it. I had met Jinder in 2013, I guess, 2012.
And you met her on an airplane. She was sitting beside you. Yeah. That's unbelievable.
And she's a writer. So she actually wrote an article about it in Britain. Wow. And I used to get mad at her. I said, you're just exaggerating the truth here. Like, you're exaggerating the truth in the article. But actually, it was published in one of the women's magazines in Britain, that how we met. But anyway, I think I have to give her a fair bit of credit, because I was quite happy at Tennis Canada coming out of cancer. I will tell you, I had been offered the CEO job of the Canadian Olympic Committee after Vanock, and nearly went and then changed my mind and stayed at Tennis Canada. Then I met Jinder, and you know, that brought a whole new element to my life. And I think it kind of, you know, pinch me to say there's more to life. And what had happened is the headhunter for the LTA had called, and I showed no interest. I just said, you know, no, I'm not interested in going. I'm happy at Canada. File closed. And then the ATP, the men's tour, their headhunter called and said, look, they're looking for a new CEO. Would you be interested? And for whatever reason, that job kind of interests me. And so I said, I think I'm going to apply for it. And make a long story short, One of my board members at the time was a guy named Roger Martin, a world-class consultant, like an unbelievable thinker. And he was consulting with someone in Britain, and they were out having a dinner after their meeting. And the guy's name was Richard Baker he was with. And Richard Baker said, Roger, like, what do you do on the side? You're a worldwide, world-class consultant. And they also, Roger said, oh, you know, a bunch of things, but I'm also, you know, the chair of Tennis Canada. Or the past chair of Tennis Canada. And he started talking about Tennis Canada. He didn't realize that Richard Baker was on the board of the LTA. And I guess Roger praised me top to bottom about the things I had led and changed. So Richard Baker went back to the chair of the LTA and said, have you guys talked to this guy in Canada? They checked the files and they turned us down. So, well, let's go back. So they came back and asked me, I would immediately go into the short list. And I said to them, well, you know what? It's kind of interesting. I'm already applying for the ATP job. I might as well apply for your job because I'm willing to move. And so I got into the pecking order for the LTA job. And I make, you know what? It came around. Roger obviously knew. I shared it with him. Because that was part of my style. Like at the end of the day, you know, good people look for jobs every once in a while or called. And
sure,
it's not disloyal. It's just, you know, it's your life. And Roger said to me, Michael, I'm going to be honest with you. He said, I think you're better in the LTA job than you are the ATP job. And it's because you're a builder. And the LTA is about building, where the ATP, you're always going to be in a conflict situation because you're managing player reps and tournament reps. And it's going to be difficult. And I don't think it's necessarily going to manage to your strength, eh? Like, you're a good consensus builder and all, but you're a builder and you're not, you don't want to be in this ongoing tug of war and be the deciding vote and everything else. Now, I don't think I would have got the ATP job anyway, but I got the LTA job. And then just before I was announced, I called the ATP and said, I'm dropping out. And I got the LTA job. So again, you know, you talk about things not being a straight line. That was like so crooked. It was such a crooked line.
Yeah, you turned them down.
I had turned them down from interviewing. Like I said, no, I'm not interested. And then they came back. And I remember, you know, my first interview was with my future chairman. And we've actually met at the U.S. Open. And we talked for the whole day. Like David was going to know everything about me. And then he also met Jinder, who was down with me at the time, my wife. And then I went back to London and interviewed. And I still remember, Jordan, I went to London to interview, and I was going to Davis Cup in Serbia with Canada. And they offered me a job in London before I left. And so I knew, and I accepted. I knew I was leaving. I just hadn't resigned. And there I am cheering Canada on. A couple people actually said to me, you know, Michael, well, there was times when you were watching that we didn't think you were there. Like your mind wasn't there. And I don't think it was, because I knew this was the last time, or at least I thought this was the last time that I was going to be cheering Canada, because I was going to run British tennis. Little did I know I was going to come back and do it again.
That's anything about your decision making, Michael, that you've learned over your career and life in terms of, you know, taking that role or decision making it as a leader of Tennis Canada, or even you said you might have taken the job as CEO of Canadian Olympic Committee. What have you learned about decision making, and what's your style?
I think I'm not necessarily sure I always applied this. You want to get emotion out of it. You want to be as fact based as possible. You'll want to look at short and long-term consequences, and all those things are important. I think even if you're ultimately going to make the decision, you want to get other voices at the table on that end. But, you know, good leaders have to make decisions. Like at some point in time, you may have to make, not everything can be consensus. And even if you want a consensus, you may never get there. So you're ultimately going to have to make the decision. And, you know, that's a trademark of good leaders, being able to make that decision in that end. The other thing I would say, and it probably relates more to career, is like, it isn't a straight line. I could never have predicted everything I was going to do. I also think at times, don't overthink it. Like, I made some mistakes. Like, I made some mistakes along the way. And, you know, they may have cost me, but in the long haul, they didn't cost me. And I think you learn more from your mistakes than your adversities. Like, you know, I made a mistake when I took the job at Skydome. You know, I was the senior sales marketing person at Maple Leaf Sports. And Skydome came, they were coming out of bankruptcy. And they offered me the job, I don't know what it was, chief operating officer, CEO, whatever. And I probably didn't do my due diligence on it. I still remember talking to my boss at the time, who was Richard Petty. And he said, don't go, Michael. It's not set up for success. And I just ignored him and went anyway. But it wasn't set up for success because they weren't in control of the Blue Jays. And so, and the Blue Jays had wanted the building and didn't get it. And so you can imagine the relationship. It was a really difficult relationship between Skydome and the Blue Jays at the time. And I remember talking with the then president of the Blue Jays after the fact, Bob Nicholson, and him saying to me, look, Michael, you got to realize something. You're a good guy and everyone wanted to see you successful, but the Blue Jays had wanted control of the building. And therefore, we weren't going to jump through hoops to help you be successful at Skydome. And generally, you know, the Blue Jays felt that Skydome would get into cash calls and they'd have to sell. And guess what? Like, I lasted 6 months. It wasn't for me. I went to Molson's as the, you know, the head of marketing in that end. And eventually, yeah, they cash calls and Rogers bought that building for a sum. So guess what? And it was Labatt. It was actually Labatt who owned the Blue Jays at the time. And Hubert was the president. And he was right. I remember going to see Hugo when I was in post at Skydome and him saying to me, Michael, like, just know that whether it's this year or next year or 2 years from now, those owners are not going to be able to cover the cash calls. And he was right.
Wow. Thanks for bringing up, you know, it's good to know, like, we all do that. We all go through times where maybe we look back and we're like, hey, we didn't make the right call, but we made a call. We made a decision. What's one thing throughout tennis? Like, I know on your LinkedIn page, you've got this like awesome blazer. You've got your arm in the air. Who won that time? Or do you remember that? Where was it?
Yeah, no, I've got an autograph from Milos on it, Milos Raonic. So basically one of the perks of my job at the LTA is being CEO is I got to sit in the royal box for every session of tennis during Wimbledon. Okay. Now, it was the back row, which is fine. And you didn't have a dedicated seat, which is fine. But you got to sit in the royal box. It was very, very special. And Milos, this was 2016. And Milos Raonic was having a great run. And in the semifinal, he was playing Roger Federer. And I was sitting in the royal box. And the fans were obviously cheering for Roger Federer. Like, they loved Roger Federer and Brednan at Wimbledon. But Milos won. And I was cheering for Milos in the royal box. And that photo is me with my arm up after he had just aced Roger for the winning point, and he was walking towards the net to, you know, to meet Roger Federer. And he had now got to the Wimbledon final. And it was someone I knew behind the royal box who took that photo, me and Aaron. Now, what's telling about the photo is that technically people are not supposed to cheer in the royal box. And you're for sure not to kind of show that kind of emotion. But I think the Brits and the All England Club kind of just looked the other way and said, it's Michael. He's Canadian. A Canadian man has never made the final. It's okay. But the finishing the story is Milos is obviously in the final now against the Brit, Andy Murray. And we're having a management committee meeting of Wimbledon the Sunday morning, which they always do. They just talk about the results and everything else. And at the end of the meeting, my chairman from the LTA pulls me aside and says, look, I just got to, you know, mention something to you. You know, like, it's a Canadian playing a Brit today. And if the press see you cheering for Milos, this will be like on the front page of the sport page, because that's the press in Britain. They're always looking for sensationalism. And I turned to David. I said, David, don't worry. I know who butters my bread. And I use that term, actually. Now, in the end, I was cheering for Milos without showing it. He didn't win. He lost in straight sets to Andy Murray. But I'll finish the story by saying one of the further perks of the Royal Box is the players after the match actually walk inside the building off court. They come up the stairs to the Royal Box. Like there's a lounge behind the Royal Box. So they come up the stairs to the lounge. You can imagine everyone's waiting for Andy Murray.
Yeah.
The person who lost comes first. So I'm standing at the top of the stairs. I don't have to push or shove or whatever, because everyone else was waiting for Andy Murray to come. And I got to actually give Milos a hug, tell him I was so proud of him. It was a very, very special moment. So that arm in the air that's on my LinkedIn page, Milos has actually autographed that for me because he thought it was pretty darn special too. It was probably the highlight of being in Britain at that time, because I got to see some Canadians do so well at Britain. I saw Milos Lund the final, unfortunately lose the final, but no Canadian man had ever got to the final with them. I saw Eugenie 2 years earlier lose the final. No woman had ever got to the final. And I also saw Dennis win the junior final. And I saw Vasek Pospisil win the doubles final. And in that case, I was in the Royal Box and he got his trophy for winning by coming into the Royal Box. And he turned around and there I am. Here he goes, Michael, I didn't know you were here. So he's in the Royal Box and he turned around and there's this old CEO from Tennis Canada to congratulate him. So I saw an awful lot of success from Canadians at Wimbledon. And I will say, after Milos lost the final, they have a champions dinner. And my wife and I were always invited to it. And it's at a museum, downtown London, whatever. It's a phenomenal show that Wimbledon puts on. And the president of Wimbledon actually got up and made a speech. And he said, even though Milos didn't win today, Canada is the country of success at this year's Wimbledon. Because Dennis had won the junior final and Milos had lost the men's final. And man, I was proud. Like I hear him running the LTA. But I'm a proud Canadian.
And you should be. And I mean, we could go forever on this podcast. And Michael, what you did for Canadian tennis, right from the success the pros had, and I know it was a group and team effort, but whether it was Bianca Andreescu or Jeannie Bouchard, Milo Sranić, Shapovalov, Lila Fernandez, like all of these players, and what you did from a grassroots level, we could go into it with the tennis, the training facility in Montreal. Like you need to be very proud, because under your leadership, there were so many things accomplished. You know, as we come closer to the end of this, I just wanted to ask, I know you're on the board. I think you're a volunteer board member in Northern Super League, the Women's Canadian Soccer Professional League. And, you know, you're on a few other boards. What are you up to now and what keeps you energized and excited?
Yeah, so just to clarify, I did some volunteer work for the Northern Soccer League before they staffed up. I'm not involved anymore because they fully staffed up and they didn't need my volunteering time. But I enjoyed the 4 or 5 months helping out in the early days. And I also helped out the Calgary Wild team before they brought on owners. So other than an odd call, I'm not really involved in that end. But I'm still doing some consulting for Tennis Canada on facilities. I did some work for the Canadian Olympic Committee earlier in the year, kind of a bespoke project. I now sit on the, I'm a volunteer board director of the biggest community tennis club in Canada, in Alberta, the Austin Victor Tennis Club. And I've got a couple other fires in the iron that I'll announce, before the new year. So I'm keeping myself busy on a part-time basis. It was time for me to move out of full-time work, but being a workaholic and being kind of one-dimensional, I need to do things. And I'm getting kind of this mix of doing volunteer work and doing some paid consulting. And I will hopefully in the next year or so, I'll be nominated to be on an NSO board. Like I'd like to be on a national sport governing board. And I'm just taking my time, but you know, hopefully there's someone out there that sees my history and my expertise and can see some value in it. And I'd love to give back to the sport that way.
That's incredible. And I know you'll do great things. Michael, I always end this with three like zigzag questions where you can answer them with one word or a sentence because it's not a straight line. I've got to know, other than that Milos Raonic match, was there another tennis match that stood out that filled you with the most pride that you witnessed?
I think it was watching, I wasn't there, but it was watching the run of Milos Raonic breakthrough. Like he was 150 in the world at the end of the year. I had had breakfast with him and his father had said to me, let's have breakfast when my son gets to the top 50 or top 100. And by the time we had breakfast in March, he was already 40 in the world. And so I saw Milos breakthrough in Australian Open. I saw him win on TV. I saw him win in California and I saw him lose a final in Memphis and he had arrived. And it was great to see because, you know, he got to be three in the world. And I guess the second one would be, I was lucky enough to be at the US Open when Bianca won. And that was unbelievably special. Like how she won that match over Serena, come back, you know, when it was 5-love and it's 5-5 and still win 7-5. She's an amazing talent. And Bianca Andreescu is a lovely person. I text with her all the time. She's a real talent and hopefully she can get over her injury woes and get back to the top 10.
Oh, I hope so. It was incredible. I watched that match on TV to see it. Whether it was the cancer journey or some other things in your life that didn't go to plan, what is something from a resiliency standpoint you always keep in mind when maybe life's not going the way you thought?
Yeah, I think it was the cancer. You know, you just can't predict these things. And, you know, and I'm 67 years of age now. So, you know, I haven't got them in now. I wear hearing aids and I've got early signs of glaucoma. So I'm putting eye drops in my eyes and I just got to realize like, you know, time does catch up with you and get the most out of it. Like I do think part of the reason, a lot of people said to me, why are you retiring? Like you've got so much energy and everything else. It was time for me. It was time for change. But I also think, hey, you know, it's time also for me to do a better job of looking after my health. And because I'm kind of an all or nothing person, I was more likely to do it if I'm kind of semi-retired in that end. So I think the cancer has influenced me that, you know, who knows? I still remember I had to get a valuation for a pension through a divorce. And the doctor said, you know, you're on average, you'll live to be 73. I remember telling him, don't be optimistic because it's about pension allocation. So 73, that's, you know, that's what, 5 years from now. So you got to live life to the fullest.
Live life to the fullest. And is there any advice you give when you speak to people or you think, you know, even about your kids that you passed on about your own career or people that want to look for a career in sport?
Two things come to mind. One is, and I've actually had the pleasure of mentoring a few people since I retired. You know, people will call, they've lost their job, they're looking for guidance. And I always say to them, good people lose their jobs all the time. Don't take it personally. You might not have deserved what you got, but this happens. And you need to have the confidence to know it's just a U-turn you've got to have and you will leverage it into something else. I look at myself and say, I lost my job in Molson's. I wouldn't have ended up at Tennis Canada if I hadn't lost my job in Molson's. And those 20 years in tennis were probably the best working career part of my, you know, 40-year work life in this end. So the advice I give people is good people lose their jobs all the time. Get past it and retain your confidence. And I think the other piece of advice I give people who want to get into sports is, and this may not be true now, when I got into sports, because that was back in, you know, 1995. But I say, look, at the end of the day, go get the best job in the area that you like. So if you want to do marketing, go get the best marketing job. If you want to do sales, go get the best sales job. Get the experience before you go into sport, because sport isn't necessarily the best teaching ground. Okay, it just isn't. Now, that might not be fair anymore to say that. So I'm making a sweeping statement in that end. But I think because I had worked in really good companies for 10 years before I went to sport, I actually think I was better equipped to be successful in sport.
That's amazing advice. Michael, thanks so much for being open, vulnerable, and sharing the time with me. I really enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it as well. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Michael.
What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it. You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.